HPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Autism is a behavioral condition often marked by difficulty communicating, interacting socially, and at times extreme sensitivity to sound or touch or light. For many years, most doctors viewed autism as something to be managed, not cured. But that changed earlier this year, with new research suggesting a small number of young children diagnosed with autism had no signs of it by the time they were teenagers. Although these cases are rare, the news was pretty exciting for those involved in this field. Many said it shows the power of early diagnosis and early intervention. As the study's author told the New York Times, these people did not just grow out of their autism. Therapists and parents put in years of work. Still, treatment can be hard to come by. Insurance coverage for this condition is often sketchy. That may be because autism is tough to diagnose, called a spectrum disorder, with symptoms and their severity varying wildly, and the spectrum itself expanding and narrowing over time. Also, autism is not improved by a pill, but rather by years of regular, often expensive, behavioral therapy. Today in The Exchange, an audit of autism, where we stand in understanding it, treating it, and helping people cope with it. Let's hear from you if you have experience with this. What obstacles have you faced? If you're a parent or a teacher who's dealt with autism, what challenges have you seen? And in general, what questions or comments do you have about this condition? The news that it might be curable, and whether at times this disorder is overdiagnosed. Give us a call, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, theexchange@nhpr.org is the address. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And joining us by phone from Connecticut is Dr. Inga Marie Eikstee, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Connecticut. She worked on that study I mentioned showing some children may recover from autism. And Dr. Eikstee, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
Also with us, Michelle Abbott, mother of two girls with autism and clinical coordinator for Gateways Therapy Services in Nashua. And Michelle, good to have you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
And also with us, Ray Sonnenmeyer, clinical associate professor in UNH's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders and at the Institute on Disability. Ray also works in the field with autistic children. And Ray, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks.
And Ray, I want to start with you. Just for the layperson who has no experience with autism, define what it is.
So we often see differences in how children develop in their social skills, in their communication skills, and in their behaviors, which are often observable in the kinds of things that they choose to play with, what captures their attention, as well as some of the sensory differences that you mentioned. I think the hallmark of the condition is the differences in social interaction. Children tend to have difficulty with that give and take, the back and forth of what we kind of consider to be conversational behavior, and that tends to be more challenging for individuals. Many individuals also have difficulty with communication, often in the social communication, so directing the words to someone so that they know that you're talking to them can be a challenge. Some individuals who have a lot more words might go on and on and on about a particular topic. So, again, that spectrum idea that you mentioned, there's kind of a range of challenges that we see, but the three areas that we look at are social, communication, and behavior as we see it through play and attention and interest.
And some kids with autism, from what I understand, Ray, correct me if I'm wrong, talk very late in their development and often talk very little.
Yes, there are some children who don't use words to communicate, but can learn to communicate using other means of communication, such as sign language or communication devices.
Michelle, how did it manifest itself in your daughters? What were some of the things that they did or didn't do that kind of tipped you off that they might have autism?
For my oldest child, Sarah, she was a very different situation. She had regression autism. So she made all her milestones. She had words. And like a light bulb switch, she got sick and lost everything probably within a few weeks. So for us, it was very evident that something was wrong with her.
Well, that's devastating. And how old was she when that happened?
She was 14 months.
Wow.
And so I actively got involved, knew something was wrong, pushed the pediatrician to have her evaluated. And she received a diagnosis very young, and we started applied behavioral analysis therapy at 16 months with her. And for my youngest daughter, Alyssa, knowing that she had a sibling, we knew that there was a high risk that she could potentially have autism or a developmental disorder. We actually enrolled her in an early child markers program, actually through UNH, and they followed her from birth. And by 12 months old, she was showing all signs of autism, and we got her started right at 12 months with therapy.
So you can tell that early. That's really young.
It was, you know, because we knew what we were looking for. So it's not like we were a new parent, didn't know about autism. We've already walked in those shoes. So we wanted to be sure that she got the earliest intervention possible so she could be successful. And she is.
From what we've heard, early intervention, that's really key. And we'll talk about that a little bit later for sure. And Dr. Ikes-T, when the news came out about the study that you worked on, that some kids with autism who were diagnosed young had no symptoms by the time they were teenagers, this was a huge deal. One researcher said, quote, many of us would rather have our tooth pulled than use the word recover. Why is that, Dr. Ikes-T? Why is it sort of taboo to use the word recover?
Well, we're starting in our within our group, we're starting to use that word now because we feel like the evidence is now quite clear that that it's sort of okay to say that. But the people have been very reluctant because this is a behavioral disorder, and yet we know that there are underlying neural differences in brain development, brain structure and function. And until we really understand whether the brain structure and function has resolved and changed, it's a little unclear to be able to say for sure whether a child is recovered or just has developed a lot of workaround strategies. So I think that's been why people have wanted to be very cautious in using that word, that term.
So it manifests itself, Dr. Ikes-T, through behaviors, but researchers like you know that there are underlying physical causes.
Yes, and so the real challenge one of the many challenges in this field is that we haven't identified a single clear biomarker that is present in every kid with autism but isn't present in kids without autism. So we don't have a single sign yet like you might have with a positive test for strep or something like that.
There's no autism gene that we know of so far.
There's no single autism gene, right? So we haven't identified a single physiological indicator of autism, and so people call that a biomarker. That's been something that many groups are looking really diligently to find, because that would be really helpful. But right now, what we have to rely on is clinicians' judgments of the behavioral symptoms of autism, and that's the only way to be sure about the diagnosis at this point. That said, I think clinicians, the data say that autism is one of the most reliable diagnoses of disorders that we have. So when you have an experienced clinician, that clinician is going to agree with other experienced clinicians at very high rates about whether a child does or does not have autism.
So a reliable diagnosis means it's a little easier to diagnose than, say, ADD. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Ikes-T?
Yeah, or that people will be more likely to, everybody that sees the kid that has experience with that disorder will be likely to agree. So they'll both be able to recognize when a child has it and notice it, and they'll be able to recognize that a child does not have it and maybe has some other difficulty.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then lots more to talk about. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. What questions or comments do you have about autism and this news about a possible cure for a limited number of kids? Also, if you have personal experience with this, if you're a parent or a teacher who deals with autistic kids, for example, what challenges do you see? The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Ray Sonnenmeyer, real quick to you, we were getting into a little bit with Dr. Ikes-T about the diagnosis, and she said autism is a pretty reliable diagnosis. A lot of different clinicians will come to the same conclusion. It's tricky, though, for the uninitiated because it's often called a spectrum disorder. So Tell us what that means, Ray, and how that makes it a little trickier to diagnose this and say for sure that someone has autism.
Well, one of the things about making a diagnosis is that you need to gather information from lots of people who know the child well, including the parents, the teachers, other family members, and as well as experienced clinicians. You can see differences in behaviors that are consistent with challenges in social interaction, for example. But you might have one child who is withdrawn, playing off by themselves, not really playing with other children, and yet you can have another child who's somewhat awkward in how they might be trying to get into a social interaction with his peers. They both might have symptoms of autism, but you can see that they're very different from one another. Likewise, we were talking about communication differences. Some children don't talk. Some children talk a lot. Or too much. And it's really the quality of their communication that would raise some questions in a examiner's mind about whether or not they may or may not be on the autism spectrum. The diagnosis is really best made by a team of people. So I happen to be a clinician on the Seacoast Child Development Clinic team at the University of New Hampshire. We have a team of people, including a pediatrician. I'm a speech-language pathologist, occupational therapist, who all are involved in looking at the child from different perspectives. And that's really critical in terms of having this reliable diagnosis that we were talking about.
And one more quick question for you, Michelle. One of the other aspects of autism that we've heard about is, again, this extreme sensitivity to noise, activity, light, sound. Do your daughters have that? Because I've heard that's really challenging for parents.
It's interesting because you mentioned a spectrum disorder. So when I look at my own children, they're from one end to the other, and so
really,
they're opposite children. And so I do have one child that tends to be more sensitive. The other one actually seeks it and enjoys hearing the loud sounds and probably is one of those children that help make those loud sounds. So I can see it from both perspectives.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. And if you're on the line, stay there. We'll take your calls in just a minute. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Turning mostly sunny from north to south across most of the state today. High 60 to 65 degrees. Mostly sunny from the mountains north. Highs there 50 to 55. More of our update on autism on The Exchange and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the latest on the Boston investigation and the limits of security. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock, developing new sustainable models of healthcare, improving lives for generations to come. Information at dartmouthhitchcock.com. From UNH's undergraduate research conference through April 27th, showcasing the results of hundreds of student research projects in over 20 venues in Durham and Manchester, unh.edu/URC. And the Turner Group of Concord architects, engineers, and building scientists celebrating over 20 years of creating sustainable buildings for a healthy environment, online at hlturner.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the latest news on the research and challenges surrounding autism. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. If you have questions or comments or observations about this condition, the news that we've been talking about a possible cure for it, also the idea that some feel this disorder is overdiagnosed. We've certainly been talking about the difficulty of diagnosing autism. Also, if you're a parent or a teacher who deals with autistic kids, we'd love to hear your stories and challenges. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, Dr. Eikstein, I did want to return to you. We talked earlier about the study that you helped work on showing that some children may recover from autism. But as we said, you know, they didn't just outgrow it. It wasn't this miracle. It was through a lot of years of hard work and one-on-one behavioral therapy. What does that work look like, Dr. Eikstein?
Well, and we hopefully will hear from Michelle Abbott about this, too. She probably experiences it really intensely from the other side. It is, as you said, hard work. So families from as early as possible, are engaged with their children and with a team of professionals who are doing early intensive behavioral intervention. And the data, not from our study, but from a variety of studies, suggests that this intervention is most effective when families are really engaged and extending what the professionals are doing with the children into family time. So trying to all use the same strategies and work on the same goals at the same times. It's really an intensive a sort of team effort to help a child learn a variety of skills from as early as possible so that we can push them onto a typical sort of developmental trajectory or pathway.
And some of the headlines surrounding this research that you worked on when it first came out said kids might outgrow autism, might be cured. How do you feel about that, Dr. Eichstein, outgrow autism?
I hope we can not say that because that makes it, I think that really underestimates the intensive effort that is required from a whole team of people to help lift this child into sort of reaching a bunch of different developmental goals. It's not something that just unfolds naturally in the way that growth, you know, you get taller without particular effort. This is something that really does require a lot of intensive effort.
And is there concern, Dr. Eichstein, that, you know, okay, so you track these kids who were diagnosed early, and then by the time they were teens, they had no symptoms. Is there any concern that after 5 years of no, you know, regular therapies, they might slip back? And pardon me if that's not the right way to put it, but do you know what I'm saying?
I do. Let me just say one thing. Our study was not a longitudinal study, so we were not tracking these kids over time.
I see.
That would really maybe that is clearly a next sensible step to take. But ours was really an initial effort to see, is this kind of optimal outcome possible? Some of the kids were children that were identified in one of our practices when they were very young, and now we're seeing them many years later. But most of the children in the study were children who were referred to us by clinicians. So we were looking backwards retrospectively at their early records and their early history. And I believe that our data is persuasive because we went to a great deal of work to establish that the children did have a diagnosis of autism when they were younger. So we're very confident on that based on not just parent report, but we have a lot of clinician reports from that time period, and we have some other data I can talk about if we have time for that. But I'm sorry, now I talked about that, the non-longitudinal.
Just the idea that, you know, is there any fear that these children who seem to be cured might revert, might slip back after, you know, no more therapy?
Yeah, I mean, that is, I guess, a possibility somehow, but I don't feel that. I think is not one of the things that we need to really worry about. Because the children that we're seeing, honestly, when we looked at the first videotapes, tears were in our eyes because the children that we were seeing looked so terrific. They have peer skills. They talked about, you know, skateboarding and their boyfriends and girlfriends and friendships and their goals, and they made eye contact and they had wonderful prosody and conversational skills. And I don't think those were skills that I think they acquired after lots of years of effort and training and practice. And it's, you know, once you know how to ride a bike, I don't think you sort of forget how just because you didn't ride a bike for a couple of years.
Michelle, what do you think? What do you think about this in terms of your own life and your own daughter's, the possibility of cure?
It differs from each child. So for my older child, Sarah, I would say she has a much more severe form of autism. As a parent, you know, like Dr. Eichstein said, it's a lot of effort for our family. So I still have that goal for her. My youngest daughter, Alyssa, absolutely. I would agree that even at 6 years old, she's on her way to recovery.
Wow.
She is, like I mentioned, she is mainstreamed in school. She has no supports. She started early intervention at 12 months. We put a lot of effort, therapy, time, and she's very successful. She's very social, has friends. And I'm very, very happy with her outcomes so far.
And when you say no supports, in this instance, that's a good thing. She doesn't need extra help in the classroom.
That's correct. I mean, am I saying she's 100% recovered? No, we still have some things that we need to work on socially with her. But I think in the long run, I think she'll lose her diagnosis.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's take Sandra in Concord. Hi, Sandra. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. No problem. I'm happy to chat. I have an 8-year-old son who was diagnosed at Crotchet Mountain in New Hampshire when he was young, and he is fully recovered.
Already at age 8?
Yes, at the age of 8. He actually lost his diagnosis at the age of 5. He went yearly to Crotchet Mountain for checkups, and at the age of 5, they considered him no longer needing the diagnosis.
Wow. So how did they do that, Sandra?
Well, I was calling mostly to bring up a controversial subject of we had some genetic testing done on our son, looking at his detoxification pathways. And we decided to try chelation as a form of therapy for him, as well as vitamin B12 injections. And we saw remarkable progress in his developmental milestones with both of those treatments. And I'm a firm believer that that is what brought him to who he is today.
Sandra, thanks for calling. And Ray, this comes up a lot when we talk about autism, not just the intensive, you know, one-on-one work with a child, but people do call in about diet, vitamins, and so forth. What do you think, Ray?
Well, first thing, I'm not a medical doctor, so I need to be careful about offering any advice.
But I know you've heard a lot about this.
I have heard about this. And one of the things that the geneticist that I work with is to be very cautious. So these interventions may work with an individual child, but they need to be highly supervised by a medical professional, and that there has to be a good reason to go down that path. So it sounds like in Sandra's case, they researched it. They had some good information that they thought that that was a reasonable path to go down. It's not necessarily something that everyone should try. So I would want to be a little bit cautious about that.
Well, and congratulations, Sandra. And it worked for her son, so that's good. But you're saying you can't just automatically now say it works for everybody. Here's an email on that same note. And Sandra, thanks for the call. This is from Chrissy. She says, I have two kids who regressed into severe autism by 2 years old. We have treated them both intensively, 35 hours a week of applied behavioral analysis, and have been very proactive in trying to restore their immune function by changing their diets, reducing their heavy metal load, etc. Levi is now 5. Sila, excuse me if I'm pronouncing that wrong, is 3.5. Both doing very well, and I believe they are firmly on the path to recovery. Levi is in a typical kindergarten classroom and is reading up a storm. Chrissy says, tell people that autism awareness is good, but autism action is better. What do you think about this, Dr. Eichstein?
I love that message that, you know, back in the old days, not that old, but 10 and 20 years ago, what we mostly heard was that parents were going to pediatricians and saying, I'm very worried about my child, you know, he is not speaking. And the message they overwhelmingly got from pediatricians was, oh, boys always talk later. Oh, he's a late bloomer. Let's wait and see. And I think that's a really misguided approach, because waiting and seeing means losing the chance to jump in and make important changes really early on. The amount of you know, the pushing that you need to do at age 3 to get a kid back on a typical developmental trajectory is really different than the amount of pushing that's needed at age 5. So taking action early is really critical. And I think one positive change is that the I don't know if Michelle Abbott and others would agree, but that the stigma associated with an autism diagnosis is lower now. I think people are much more familiar with the term. It doesn't seem so scary, perhaps, to outsiders. And the cost of getting an early diagnosis, I think, is much outweighed by the potential benefits of getting a kid all those important services really early, as early as possible.
Do you want to jump in here, Michelle, as well?
Yes, just to reiterate some of the callers that called, for both my children, we also were very much part of the special diets, doing very, very random, many supplements, different therapies.
Different vitamins.
Oh, absolutely. And I will say for the diets, both my children had a lot of predispositions, a lot of medical issues that followed their autism, seizure disorders, immune deficiencies, colitis. So we had many challenges in addition to autism. And I want to agree with both of those families. And as Ray said, we had many physicians follow us, support us. There were certain treatments, IVIG specifically, that helped my children with their immune system. And so I do recommend families looking into that, especially if they have children with predispositions, because it can make a huge difference.
Let's take another call. This is Cindy in Hudson. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air. Welcome. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks, Laura. And hello to Michelle. I know Michelle, our kids actually go to school together.
Mm-hmm.
And I have actually a fairly similar story with Michelle. My first child wasn't speaking real words at the age of two, and luckily my doctor asked if he was and recommended us for early intervention. And then our second child was only 19 months younger when I saw similar signs in him as his older brother. I took him to a neurologist at the age of 20 months to make sure that he had an autism diagnosis, because of my older boy was in school at the time in the preschool, and I knew that there was the specialized ABA program, Applied Behavior Analysis, and I knew that my younger son would definitely need that even more than my older boy. And I just wanted to share that one of the really intense challenges that parents face is the fact that my husband and I pretty much think daily about the fact that my younger son will probably be living with us for the rest of our lives.
Mm.
And unfortunately, that, you know, it won't be the rest of his life.
So, wow, that's tough. So you're thinking he won't be able to go out on his own, Cindy?
No, no.
Yeah.
I mean, he does speak, and he is a smart child. But his interaction with the world is limited to, you know, what he allows. He's in his own head, in his own world a lot. And like one of your guests talked about, the doctors saying, oh, just wait until they get a little bit older, you know, that was that's not good advice.
Yeah, Cindy, that's tough, and thanks for calling. Ray, you know, this is kind of the other side of the coin, isn't it? We've been talking about how great it is, and Michelle's daughter showed great progress, and Sandra, who called earlier, has seen great progress, but this isn't always a happy ending.
So this is one of the concerns that I have about using the word cure. I liked the way the folks in Connecticut talked about optimal outcome, and that the optimal outcomes are really based on looking at the supports and services that families are able to access. The work at the Institute on Disability is really around making inclusive communities, and what is it going to take to support individuals so that they can achieve whatever their goals, whatever their potential is. We know many individuals with the appropriate supports and services can make great gains. It may be living in the community with support. It may be working at a job with support. So I appreciate Cindy's concerns. Her child is still young, and I think that as research continues, we're learning more and more about how to provide really effective supports that people can live the best lives that they can.
Wow.
And that it's more about autism acceptance than thinking about curing autism.
Well, Cindy, good luck. That's tough, and maybe Ray's answer offers you a little bit of hope. I want to bring another voice into our conversation now. This is Amy Frechette. She's a young woman with Asperger's who works as a self-advocate at UNH's Institute on Disability. And Amy Frechette, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Hello. Yes, I work with Ray. Michelle knows me, I'm sure. Maybe some of your other listeners know me just because of my role as the governor-appointed self-advocate with the New Hampshire Council on ASD and, working with the IOD as well. So
ASD is Autism Spectrum Disorders, Amy?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm sure a lot of people know who I am and respect.
When you say to somebody, I have Asperger's, what does that mean to you, Amy?
I think there's two answers. One answer is the answer I would usually give our students is that it's a lot of things. It means a lot of different things to a lot of people, as you've already heard from a couple of parents. And then I would say, for me, it's a way of being, thinking, my personality. It helps to shape my identity. I wouldn't say it's my whole identity, but I think it certainly, you know, helps shape who I am and what I do for work.
How so, Amy? How does it shape your personality?
It makes me, I tend to see things in black and white, which I know isn't always the best, but sometimes you want somebody to see things in black and white. Being able to have a high attention to detail when it comes to helping my colleagues with grant writing and research papers, being able to pick up on grammatic errors and reference errors or, you know, different things like that.
So extreme attention to detail is helpful in some situations.
It's very helpful. In fact, we're going to start making a little fun for myself because I'm probably one of the best people capable of this type of activity at where I work. So, you know, I should start making big money for this.
Well, what situations, Amy, seem to cause you the most trouble that, you know, most people wouldn't even really think about?
I think for me, it's certainly academics, especially in terms of talking about like post-secondary, so college. I have a lot of needs when it comes to learning different classes. I have a college degree, but I haven't pursued more college, and it's because I find a lot of academic work really difficult. Social situations with a lot of people can be kind of nerve-wracking. I have a service dog, Judah, who accompanies me on a lot of our activities and adventures, so that kind of isn't as much of a problem with the anxiety and the social discomfort and whatnot that would go along with that. That would be a few areas, I suppose.
Well, Amy, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much, and maybe hearing from you will help that mom who called in earlier who was concerned about her son growing up to be an adult, because here we are hearing from you doing really well. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
That's Amy Frechette, again, a young woman with Asperger's, works as a self-advocate at UNH's Institute on Disability. We'll take more of your calls and emails after a short break.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and the Lexus ES Hybrid. Combined EPA and rated 40 mpg, actual mileage will vary. More at lexus.com/ESH. And Union Institute and University Brattleboro offering the weekend hybrid doctorate in psychology and master's with a concentration in counseling psychology. MyUnion.edu. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me and a panel of reporters, editors, and analysts for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
I think the House Democratic Caucus is going to determine whether casino gambling goes
through. And they've created a super committee of the House Finance and House Ways and Means committees to do it as a joint.
14 states now have some sort of a home grow provision in their laws, including, of course, Vermont.
We'll talk through the big Granite State stories of the week. The Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Friday mornings at 9 on The Exchange from NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, should New Hampshire pull back on some of the tougher provisions due to kick in its new voter ID law? Email us your questions or thoughts at exchange@nhpr.org before the program, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's an update on autism, including some new research that indicates some children may recover from this disorder. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, before we were talking about some of the therapies and some good news about how some of these are quite successful. Michelle, you mentioned the example of your younger daughter especially. But here's what I'm wondering, Dr. Eichste, does insurance cover this most of the time?
Yeah, so most of the therapies early on are coordinated. It varies a lot state by state. But there is a birth-to-three system that provides some of the very early intervention. And at three, then children graduate into the school system, and interventions are often coordinated through their educational people put together an educational package that includes intensive behavioral therapy, as well as speech-language therapy and occupational therapy, physical therapy, whatever else might be needed. So those I think parents need to work really closely as part of a team member with their educational support staff to find the best package that's going to work best for their child. But whether it's covered through school, through health insurance, that depends a lot state by state.
Let's take another call if we could. And this is Kevin in Grafton. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good. How about yourselves? Are you guys okay?
We're fine, thanks.
Good. Hey, listen, I got a lot of stuff here I want to cover, but I just want to give you an experience here. I have a 19-year-old son with autism who is he was said to have autism since he was three, and I just wanted to talk about the lack of support here from our school district and the state of New Hampshire. My son is in the Mascoma School District, and he's been in a subpar program all his life. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough knowledge of picking up on this. A year ago, my son was kicked out of his program because of behaviors, and no adjustments were ever made to help him with his behaviors or in this program. The district mandated us that all they wanted to do was put him in residential care, and they did not provide services. We found alternative ABA programming, which we had great results, and unfortunately ABA program is not covered by the state of New Hampshire in any type of insurance. We could not convince the district, despite all the great results. We had to go to due process, where we spent $46,000 to defend ourselves and get our kid his services, and despite proving inadequate programming and that they illegally kicked him out of his program and did not provide services, we ended up losing. The hearing officer headed towards the district. Now my son is placed in a day program that is not really meeting his needs, and he's regressing. And the school district is supposed to transport my son, but they were transporting him like a dog, putting him in the back of a car with a almost like he's in a cage. And he had one episode in the car. The district pulled our transportation. Now I have to transport him to what comes to 4 hours a day and 142 miles a day.
Wow, Kevin, what a struggle. And can I ask you a quick question? Your son's 19, so is he even still under the school district?
He is, till he is 21.
I see. Okay. Yeah, boy, lots of struggles, and kind of relates to what we were talking about with Dr. Ike's T. Ray, as to whether insurance covers this, whether the schools cover it. What are your thoughts there? I know you can't specifically address the details of Kevin's situation, but I've read that some people do struggle to get the help they need.
Yep. There's been a lot of effort in the state of New Hampshire to try and advocate for insurance coverage. So there's been Connor's Law that has been passed.
When did that pass?
A couple of years ago.
Okay, and so when his son was young, that might not have been in effect.
Yep, and it's in the process that people are trying to work out the details around what will actually be covered and which insurance companies will cover which services. The other thing that health insurance often does cover are the therapies. So speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, and if it's part of a coordinated program, that often can work for families.
So that is often covered.
That is often covered. The New Hampshire Council on Autism Spectrum Disorders is trying to address this very issue around the inconsistency of services across the state and where do families go when they're in these kinds of situations that Kevin's describing where things are not adequate. There's still a lot of work to be done, but there are various committees, the part of the council, who are trying to work on improving early identification and diagnosis, working on community supports and services, working on education for families. In this particular situation for Kevin, he might want to contact the Disability Rights Center for some more advice in his particular situation.
What was the name of the council that you mentioned again? That might be a resource.
The New Hampshire Council on Autism Spectrum Disorders. And I believe I gave the website that hopefully can get put up on the exchange site.
Okay. And Michelle, I know you want to jump in here. Private insurance, schools, out of pocket. It's probably a mix for you, right?
It is. I will say the first couple of years for my children, we spent close to $40,000 for each child. It is very expensive. As Ray mentioned, Connor's Law, we are seeing insurance companies now start to cover ABA services or applied behavioral services. And at Gateway Therapy Services, part of my role is helping one family at a time. Yes, the school is involved, but what happens when the child comes out of school? They're home, they're in the parents' care, there's behavior issues, there's less structure. So at Gateway Therapy Services, we are working with insurance companies to get those services covered in families' homes at this time.
Well, and that web address that you mentioned, Ray, is on our website, nhpr.org. So folks can go there and find out more. Kevin, good luck. Boy, thanks for calling in. And Tasha's calling from Merrimack. Hi, Tasha. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm
sure.
So grateful you guys are covering this subject this morning. My daughter is diagnosed on the autism spectrum. And she is also combined with ADHD, which is really it has really complicated her behavioral problems and her social skills. One thing I want to point out is she is high functioning, and I got to stress to other parents that when you start, you've got to follow your gut when you're when they're young. I had to advocate very strongly with her pediatrician. You mentioned earlier about how they will push it off and say, oh, it's just a slight delay. She might just be a late bloomer. But I saw early signs of her not having eye contact. And before I knew she was autistic, I was just intervening with those symptoms. I just refused to let her not talk to me. And I would just push for a response. And I would push for that eye contact. I would not let her talk to me, or I wouldn't speak to her until I had eye contact. So by the time she actually started public school, I had nipped a lot of that in the bud, but I had to advocate real strongly to get services for her. That's one problem that I had, and as a single parent, I really struggled with trying to get people to back me up.
Back me up, meaning like take it seriously.
Exactly. I felt that the schools saw it initially as a behavioral problem.
Yeah.
And because of the combination of the ADHD, the impulsivity that she has, in addition to the social skill awkwardness, it really just, they didn't know how to deal with it.
Well, Tasha, thanks a lot for calling, and good for you for sticking up for your kid. What do you think, Dr. Eichst? You know, others that Tasha came in contact with said, look, this is a behavioral problem. In other words, you know, tighten up the reins at home, Mom. Do a better job. You know what I mean? I mean, there are people who say, look, it's not autism. This kid is just, you know, out of control, badly behaved, a brat, you know, use whatever language you want.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a story we hear from families a lot. And when we are training clinicians here at University of Connecticut, and we, whenever we talk to professionals that are out in the community doing diagnosis and doing work, we say the first person to listen to is the parents, because the parents really know. They live with the children. They see them. They know a lot more than the professional does about the individual child. And parents' instincts are often the right thing to listen to. They're the ones that know most about the child, and we have to get used to listening to parents and not just assume that the professional knows more about the individual child.
Here's the other side of this, though, and if I could ask you, Dr. Eichst, the flip side is the concern that you do hear expressed these days that we are over-diagnosing autism. The numbers have exploded, and some people say that's because we do a better job diagnosing. Other people say, though, we are over-diagnosing, that every, you know, behavioral issue is now labeled autism. What do you think?
Well, you know, there people are working. All the epidemiologists are working hard to figure out what is the real rate of autism, and a lot of people have expressed concern that the rates seem to be snowballing or increasing. I'm not an epidemiologist, so you know, I don't have the definitive answer about this. My impression is that a huge amount of the increase in rates of diagnoses just really reflects the better awareness that we have. We have pediatricians who now are being trained or who now have learned to understand that autism might be present, and they're recognizing it much earlier, and they're much more aware of milder forms of autism. And just small changes like that can increase the rates of diagnosed kids to a greater degree. To my mind, from my perspective, this is a good thing if what it means is that children with problems with social skills, problems communicating, problems interacting, if these kids are now getting early services, I think that's just a good thing. These are kids who otherwise might have really struggled in school, had a lot of personal pain and difficulty, been bullied, you know, without the early intervention. So,
what do you think, Ray? If we're over-diagnosing, maybe that's not such a bad thing? What do you think?
I think it's important that we identify individuals, what their strengths and what their needs are. So I think that if oftentimes children get to our clinic with a question of autism and we say, no, it's not autism, but it's this. It might be ADHD. It might be a developmental delay. It might be something else. So I think there's a lot of awareness, which I think is a good thing. I think that the increase in the number of cases is not solely because we're overdiagnosing. I think we are getting much better at being able to recognize these differences in development and the subtleties of difference. I totally agree with what Dr. Eichsee is saying.
Michelle, what's your perspective on this? I wonder if you ran into people who said, you know, your kids don't have autism, you're just not tough enough.
Yes, I have.
You have?
I have. And again, I also was pushed back on the pediatrician, wait a few more months. And I do hear that ongoing from other families. And I usually say, well, you need to push back and you need to look at it because the numbers are increasing. And whether it's you know, it is an epidemic. There's a lot of controversials of where it's going. Is it environmental? Is it predispositions? So I think families are on the right track. I think everyone knows somebody with autism and knows what to look for, and that concern is with every parent now.
Here's an email from Mark who says, I'm wondering why the explosion of cases and curious if it has any anecdotal evidence relating to exponential growth in early vaccines. Mark says, your guest had a daughter get sick, and I wonder if it was shortly after a round of vaccines. This is a big issue, Dr. Eichsee, and despite multiple studies showing that there's no link at all to vaccines and autism, a lot of people still wonder.
Yeah, people are still wondering, and I think the scientific evidence is really clear that there isn't a link. Vaccines don't give kids autism. And in fact, you know, parents that are concerned, I think they need to also be concerned about the now very real and increasing risks of their children getting mumps and measles and rubella and polio and tuberculosis and, you know, these childhood illnesses that can really mark children forever and even kill them. And that's, I think, as great a risk as worrying about autism. So if people are really concerned about the vaccines, I think there are alternatives in terms of spreading out the vaccine so you're not getting them all at once, but getting them one at a time, for example, and that's certainly a workable possibility. But I think getting the vaccines is really critical to keeping your children healthy. And you should worry about that as much or more than having the vaccines giving a child autism.
Well, and Ray, given what we started out talking about this hour, again, Dr. Eichsee's research that some children could recover, this is a big deal. Where do you think we're going to be in, say, 5 years or 10 years, Ray?
There's so much research that's going on and so many advances. You know, the Combating Autism Act that was funded through the federal government has supported a lot of these research projects. We're learning more and more about what works. with individuals on the autism spectrum. I'm really encouraged by Dr. Eichsee's work in terms of this notion of optimal outcome, what contributes to it. I think we'll have a much greater understanding of that in 5 to 10 years, and that will help us design better supports and services for individuals.
Yeah, and if we could end, yeah, go ahead, Dr. Eichsee.
If I can just jump in, there's one piece of data yet from our project that we haven't finished evaluating. We haven't published any work on this, but it's something that I think is really an important additional piece of information, and that is, what are the interventions and experiences that our children who had these optimal outcomes received?
Right. What works?
Right. We have, you know, we have these kids who have optimal outcomes, and we have kids who are very similar in many dimensions, who still have the diagnosis of autism, whose parents also worked very hard and gave them lots of supports, and they still have the autism diagnosis. So it's a surprisingly effortful and laborious process to look at what interventions a child receives, because they change oftentimes on a weekly basis or a
right,
monthly basis.
As they grow. And Dr. Eichsee, lots to keep you busy over the next, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 decades. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
That's Dr. Inga Marie Eichsee, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Connecticut. She worked on the study we talked about, showing some children may recover from autism. And Michelle Abbott, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Michelle Abbott, mother of two girls with autism. She's also at Gateways Therapy Services in Nashua. And Ray Sonnenmeier, good to see you too. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Ray Sonnenmeier, she's with UNH's Institute on Disability. This is The Exchange on NHPR.